Benedict.
Amen.
I feel like I've been waiting to have open heart surgery or something, or just about to have a baby or something, I don't know. Quite nerve-wracking. Thanks, Charlie, for asking me. I know a lot of people in this room, actually, and I was just saying to somebody, I kind of almost wish I didn't know anybody, because I find it much easier to do this if I didn't know anyone for some reason. There's a lot of people I know and that have been, you know, in my life and my sort of using life as well, and it's a nice thing as well. So basically, I'm 8 years in April. I've been coming to, I should just say I'm 7 years really, shouldn't I? Wishful that, yeah. I will be 8 years in April, I'm sure. And I've been coming to meetings probably, I think it's 11 or 12 years. I first came in, I think it was the year 2000, as good as year as any. The first time I sort of got into recovery for about a year. But anyway, a bit of my background, because I've got to do this for 40 minutes. I've been saying, I mean, I do shares now, and I sort of 10, 15 minutes, I'm done. You know, that's it. And I mean, the first chair I ever did, and Charlie often pokes fun at me, I shared, and I said, oh, I'm just going to talk about recovery now. And Charlie sort of said, no, I think you might have to stop and do it another time. You're sharing for 40 minutes in an hour's meeting, which was pretty... so that went well. But yeah, but the difference, you know, I'd love to talk about me. I love to talk about me. I love to do a lot of cocaine. I love to do a lot of any different drug, really, that was put in front of me. But I was very much... And so I love to talk at everybody. And it was like that when I first got sober. Yeah, I can talk about me for... a while, but these days, you know, the ego's deflated a bit. It's still there, it rears its ugly head, but I kind of am usually done. I'm trying to say as much as I can to make it as long as possible. And I find it a bit boring, really, talking about me and you know, I don't know. I like talking about recovery, and I will do that. So I've been around nearly eight years. As I said, I used... everything. My main thing was really sort of coke and alcohol, and I was just saying to someone else, I was sitting here with my fear, and what was going around in my head was, you're not really an addict, you're not, you haven't got a fucking story, you weren't homeless, you didn't shoot up, you didn't do this, that's what was going around in my head. I've spent 7 years going to meetings, you know, and it's mad, because, you know, and for me, a lot of it as well, it's not, you know, I will say, it's my fucking thinking and my perception of people and life, the paranoia, you know, all of that sober as well. That's what I, you know, really, I think I came to my knees, you know, forget using drugs and all the rest of it. I mean, and that was the symptom of it, was, you know, using drugs. It was all the stuff that went in my head. My thinking is insane and can be insane. But yeah, so my background, sort of from South London, is Chris at Big Up South London, and Brixton. I kind of grew up on a sort of Brixton council estate. We moved in there sort of 76, something like that. Sort of white mum, mixed race, but black dad, and everybody in the estate was Scottish or Irish. And I sort of got the crap kicked out of me by sort of all the white kids in the estate, blah, 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 you know. But it's just sort of, you know, just giving you a bit of where I came from. And my house was, my dad was a lighting engineer for a band, for a reggae band, so there were sort of lots of, you know, lots of sort of massive fucking speakers in the house with reggae blaring out, which I hated as a kid. And I'd be skipping around, and sometimes there'd be all these rusters asleep on the floor from the band, you know, and I'd be sort of getting up from school and sort of, you know, tripping over them, and, you know, clouds of smoke of spliff, you know, all that stuff. And actually, before I sort of moved to Brixton, my first memory of my first experience of getting out of it, I was about three, and my dad babysat for me. This is going to be confusing, this story. I'll talk about my dad. It's my uncle that I call dad. That's what I mean. And he gave me, he was drinking a special brew, and I want Sam, you know, whatever. Apparently, this is the story they tell me. And I sort of had some of this special brew, and my mum came over, and I was pissed. I was three, and I was copying my mum on the stairs or something. She's northern, so that bastard cat. And I was kind of copying my mum, kicking the cat, and sort of drunk, basically. And it was a funny family story. My dad said, I'm not going to try and do a West Indian accent, get me wrong. He says, you know, you loved it. You know, you wanted more. I was like, more, you know. So that's kind of where it and how it started for me. And I don't have any, I don't tell that story and think, oh, my dad was outright, you know, fucking hell. I don't have all that stuff. It just, you know, that was just what happened. He's amazing, my dad. And so that was kind of, but I was growing up around that atmosphere. So drugs, alcohol, everything was very the norm. And then I think there was a time sort of throughout my, a bit older, my dad sort of went inside for dealing, and I came home and he was sort of making raps of clues, obviously dealing coke, I guess. And I just thought, all right, dad, you know, he's like, yeah, all right, hello. I think I remember running around the living room and knocking a mirror or whatever they had on the side of coke and sort of getting shouted at and stuff like that. But that was just, I didn't really think anything of it. I didn't really know, what did I know? This is quite young. So that was all the norm. And then where I lived, you know, Brixton, everyone was fucking raging. I'm still struggle with anger to this day. I really struggle with it, and rage. Everyone was raging around me. My family was raging. My mum was raging, screaming at my dad, my stepdad, you know, out the window, and everyone in Brixton was raging. It was just very angry, you know. So that's where I kind of came from. A lot of sort of, you know, just volatile behaviour from every angle. You know, go to the shop, you have come back and, you know, I've been beaten up or whatever, some boys kicked me in the street, you know, just all this stuff. So it was always like that, really. But again, just normal, sort of, that's normal life. So I kind of went into my teens, and it was just all about, then the sort of insecurity kicked in, and I had the big hang-up because, you know, the identity crisis, I suppose. It was really difficult kind of saying growing up mixed-race girl in a very white state. Then I kind of, it got more kind of mixed, and sort of other families came in, a bit more diverse, and I sort of felt very confused about what I was and who I was and all of that stuff. And I craved an identity. I was always sort of asking about what my history was and who my, you know, all this stuff, you know. But yeah, so straight into, I was very, very insecure, very sensitive, and off the back of all the name calling and feeling shit about myself, I thought the sort of solution was, and I wanted to be loved. I really sort of, I hate saying, I wanted to be loved, but I did. I wanted to be loved, I wanted to be adored. I couldn't be loved and adored enough. I wanted to be a singer, and I wanted to be a singer from a little girl. I wanted to be a singer and a film star when I was a little kid. I used to watch Wizard of Oz and just fantasise and go off and run around my little estate singing, you know, whatever. That was my fantasy from a little girl, and I thought that I didn't attach to that, of course, at that age, but now I look back and that was what I thought would obviously make me feel better and wanted and loved, you know. So I had this sort of ambition to be a singer. I sort of was all right at school. My mum basically would have battered me if I fucked up at school, and it was as simple as that, you know. So when I did, I got a good hiding and I had to stay in. So I kind of was in fear of that, so I went to school and I did my school, but throughout it, straight away, I think the people I was around to be accepted, and I realised that if I got drunk and I drank more than everybody else, I mean, I remember the first time I'd been sort of about 12, 13, and getting this pink lady, and I just did it in one. I was paralytic, and everybody was like, yeah, and I thought, yeah, fucking, you know, this is it. This is what, you know. So whatever anyone did, I tried to do it more, you know. Or if anyone, you know, everyone's doing gas and my mate, the girl's like, oh no, I don't, I'll do it. You know, it was always me that wanted to do it because it made me feel tough and it made me feel the opposite to what I felt. I kind of went up along that road, the same sort of thing. And then, you know, the environment I was in, and then it got into the kind of, I mean, it was mad because my family, we grew up in a council estate, whatever, there was, my mum struggled or whatever, but it wasn't like poverty line. But I was, you know, I was with someone today, actually, very special to me. She's been around for a long time. She was my friend's older sister. And around that time, sort of as a teenager, it was the kind of kicking into the 80s, Thatcher years, you know, heroin screws you up posters and Grangeil and all that kind of, what was it, Zammo on Smack and all that. It was all, oh, those days, those were the days. You know, so, and I kind of, and everyone, I was going to secondary school, there was a bad school called Michael Ramsey, anyone knows that in Camberwell, and there was the school Charles Edward Brooke, the girls' school, and I said to my mum, I want to go to Michael Ramsey, because I'd heard there was this boy there that, you know, he did heroin, and he wore Gucci loafers, and he was fucking, sunglasses, and I was like, yeah, I want to go there. She said, you're not fucking going there. You know, so I couldn't get to this school. And, you know, my mum was quite on it. So, yeah, anyway, but I got to those people and I couldn't wait to get to all that stuff. It was the best. To me, that's what life was all about. It was fun, you know, and fun. That's a funny word, isn't it? But, yeah, it was a laugh. So, yeah, sort of teen years, I just kind of ended up being around that. And from that early age, it's weird, I ended up with quite an obsession. My friend's sister, sorry, backtracking a bit, all my friends, bigger sister and brothers, I'm an only child in Avonlea, they were all... they were all sort of doing heroin. They all looked amazing, I thought. They were all sort of like, you know, sort of ducking and diving, you know, getting coming around selling clothes, Versace or whatever it was at the time, Gucci, coming around with expensive clothes. Every time you went to someone's house, someone would come around with a load of clothes. In Mo from EastEnders, but a bit classier. And you know, so I kind of thought, yeah, you know, that's what I want to be, you know, and I'd hear what they were doing. They were doing dodgy credit cards, dodgy checkbooks, and all that stuff. And, you know, like I say, my family weren't really particularly doing that. They were dodgy. I mean, my dad had been to prison. My mum told me it was the post office, and I thought he was working as a postman, but I really believed it as well, in the sort of Fletcher, you know, porridge sort of uniforms in them days, so I totally bought that. But anyway, sorry, I'm going off track a bit. I'm losing it now. Where was I? Yes, anyway, so I kind of got into this whole kind of obsession with that behaviour. And I thought that was what I wanted. But I also, on the other side of things, I could sing, and I wanted to be a singer. And I wanted to be, a famous singer, that will save me. But at the same time, so I had this sort of divided, I was very attracted to all the kind of madness. So sort of around 14, 15, I started getting, you know, going out and sort of doing dodgy checkbooks and fucking nicking clothes and doing all this stuff again, just for the bravado, really. And I got away with it. You know, I was very lucky. I never got arrested. I remember sort of someone... I remember taking a checkbook and a card with the driving licence, and the guy, thinking I was smart, I was about 15, all dressed up, red lipstick and all that, looking like, trying to look like Sade, and probably failing miserably. But I gave the guy the driver, he said, have you got any idea? I said, yeah, I gave him the driver's licence, sort of like that. And he said, how old are you? I said, I'm 21, you know, whatever. He said, well, this says you're 36. And I just ran off, you know. I'd just be just, run, do one. In fact, it was in Trafalgar Square. It was a Bureau de Show, and she probably just ran the corner. If it's still there. So that was kind of me, really. Just a really rubbish kind of, you know. But that's what I thought, you know. Like, I mean, I never got caught. I mean, my mother, fuck, when I think about the devastation, I know a lot of, you know, so I was heading down that road. And like I say, trying to emulate my friend's sister's, you know, my friend nicked her sister's gear and a bit of, you know, and we went sort of in our school uniforms. It was a tiny bit, it was just whatever, and we just sort of messed about trying to do it. But that was like my life's ambition, you know. I mean, that's not fucking normal, is it? It's not normal. I mean, I've got a 14-year-old daughter now. I know she doesn't think like that, at least I don't think so. But then, you know, I was very good at hiding things, so who knows? But I don't think she is that girl. So I know that it's not normal for every single 14, 13-year-old girl to, you know, have that behaviour. So anyway, it just on it went, basically. So the war stories, that's where I came from. It went on. I ended up following this ambition to be a singer. I left school when I was 16. I went straight into a record deal, Acid House, 88, brilliant, E, all of that. All the football hooligans were fucking making up, cuddling each other with Burberry Max on in wigs, in arches, you know, listening to Adonis. Do you know what I mean? That was pretty amazing. And I was making records. It was like, yeah, you know, I'm doing this. So I kind of, my using wasn't really affecting, it was, but all the other stuff it was affecting, my self-esteem, relationships, romantic friendships, that stuff, you know. I could never really maintain anything like that. I've never really had a proper boyfriend. I started going to much older guys when I was younger, all that stuff. No kind of self-esteem whatsoever, no control or boundaries around sex and all that stuff at a very young age. And so anyway, I got this deal, and I did have this record thing, and I was doing using a lot. Then I got another record deal, and I sort of, you know, it was all kind of going along, sort of, and I was kind of, but I was still going back to this double life, you know. I could sort of go off and do this stuff with the music, but then I'd kind of go back to a pub in Bermondsey and kind of get back on the old, you know, get back right on it. And I sailed along, and I suppose over time, it seemed like a bit of a slow process. It was drinking and cocaine at that point, and then I remember it was called freebasing, it was crack basically. I remember doing a bit of that sort of 15, 16 with my friend's older sisters and stuff. I didn't really know, and it's funny, Aaron was saying I was the chatty one. Everyone else just like, shut up. You know, that was me on that stuff. And it just, so I was kind of like, that was what was going on, and that was the norm. It was fine. But like I said, I was going off and doing this music thing. And but basically skipping a lot forward, I went through my 20s. I think around my early 20s, sort of going on to my third record deal at this point. Obviously, I hadn't read many big hits, but hey, I had a go. And sort of early 20s, around 23, when I was just, I just signed this big this deal, and it was great. It was a publishing deal, all that money. I went straight out and bought loads of clothes and loads of cocaine and showed off and, you know, all of that. And I remember the sort of bit, a little bit of a mini intervention. This sort of manager said to me, you know, we're worried about you. You're doing too much, too many drugs, your behaviour. I was, you know, my behaviour was terrible. I was aggressive, screaming at people, tackling them. Or, I mean, or, you know, abusing people by text and just paranoia, me, self-obsession. You know, it was always about me, everything everybody did. If two people went for a coffee without me, it was like, you know, I was just mental. I was mental, basically. I mean, it's a lot of I've got a lot of shame around that behaviour, and I suppose I'm laughing it off, but there's a lot of shame around that, being that person. And at that point, I couldn't, so I tried to stop. He gave me loads of spliff and said, just stay in for 2 weeks. So I did, and sort of tried to get stoned. I always didn't really like spliff. I'd always have some if it was there, but I hated it. Didn't like really getting stoned. And I kind of went out after that 2 weeks and decided I still wasn't going to take it. And it's the first time I'm powerless, first time ever, 23. I was in, someone said, do you want a line? And I said, yeah, you know. And I thought, I don't want to do this. And I felt that intensely, and I did it, and off I went again. And after that point, I just really wouldn't, I didn't like it. I wanted to, I thought the first time, why am I doing this? This isn't, I don't like this. And then sort of going on and going for all different times, I sort of, the record deal, that sort of, you know, the label dropped me, they kind of, whatever, it was all this stuff, and I kind of free-falled, really. I kind of got taken, I just wanted to go out and get on it. That's all I wanted to do, and look good, that's it, you know? Look good, get dressed up, go out and use, that was it. And what was wrong with that, you know? And then I kind of, again, sort of just before... Then I basically had someone that I was seeing sort of on and off for 2 years and then eventually... And I ended up getting pregnant and I wasn't with that person. He got married to somebody else at that point. It was a big scandal. And I sort of had a baby. And at that point I thought, and I remember thinking, what, you know, making a decision to have this child, and I thought, this is going to save me. I'd wanted a baby, from about the age of 19, I thought, I can't wait to have kids, because whatever I'm feeling about myself, a child, that will solve this, you know, I know it will, I can love it, it's going to love me. Had this baby, day four, she was about 4 or 5 days old, I popped out for a drink, I mean for an hour, and came back at 4 in the morning, and I used, and I drank, might be more intense for other people, and I managed not to use and drink. That's the thing, I control my using as well, very, very controlling. So when I was pregnant, I didn't do anything, but I couldn't stay stopped, that's the point. I could not stay stopped. I'd always pick up again, whether it was that 8 months of being pregnant or whatever it was, or whether it was I went out with somebody who was sober in NA, he was sober, so I was for a month, you know, and eventually I picked up again, you know. So I had this beautiful baby, I came home, I picked her up and looked at her, and I just absolutely, I sobbed my heart out, and I thought, what is fucking wrong with me? Why can't I stop using and doing this? I don't want to be doing this. And on it went, you know, and it wasn't until, like I said, the year 2000, she was about 3 or 4, a friend of mine was getting sober, and she'd been sober and in and out of this AA stuff or whatever, NA stuff, and I was like, whatever, and she'd, you know, she said, maybe you should come to a meeting, and I said, because I was moaning and sort of complaining about how bad I felt. And she said, I said, oh, I don't know, you know, so I kind of went once with her and it just all went over my head. So I'm meeting Chelsea, I just nothing, everything just was all distorted. And I went, okay, and walked out and I never thought about it again. And it was another year after that, I called this person again and said, I'm desperate, I was on my knees. I spent 3 days in my flat feeling terrible. And it was weird, it wasn't even, it was drugs, alcohol, and it was people. I'd pushed everybody away, I'd alienated, nobody could stand to be around me. It was raging, horrible, nasty, you know. And I rang her and said, I'll go to a meeting with you. And I went to my first meeting, and it was in Notting Hill, and I went in. And I listened, and I heard what people were saying, and I identified with it. I thought, wow, that's me. And afterwards, someone said to that the old, you know, you shouldn't go to meetings for, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. And I went, what? I was like, I can't. I've started doing yoga. I've started doing drumming lessons. Because I've got this enthusiasm about that kind of like, and they said, well, look, if you know, go to yoga, but you won't have yoga or drumming lessons, love, if you don't do this. And I felt frightened, and I did it. I didn't rebel. So I went, did the 90 meetings in 90 days. Amazing pink cloud, all that. Woo, this is going to be great. I remember walking to one of the meetings and seeing people I knew. shit, you know, and forgetting that they were there. But, you know, if someone said, oh, there's been a cherry with your name on it, you know, welcome sort of thing. And I just was horrified. Thought, I'm not like you. And it's funny, and I can still be like this today. It's always been about, like I say, sort of coming that South London ethic, you know, as long as you fucking look all right, everything's okay. You know, as long as you've got the right, you know, you look, you know, make yourself look okay and everything's all right. And I can still be like that today. And I went to this meeting, I waited till I felt okay. Hi! You know, and everybody knows. How are you? Great! I'm great, I'm fine, you know. Not fine, smashed to pieces, you know, in here and in here. And just sad, that sadness. I remember that feeling of real sadness, which I today don't have anymore, and I love that as well. I feel so sad. Using and drinking and crying. You know, all of that. And that's gone now, the self-pity thing. Anyway, what am I doing time-wise? Because I've got a load of time. So boring. I did my 90 music 90 days. I did that. I remember getting a sponsor. I relapsed. I always forget about this relapse after 90 days. I got a phone call from New York from a lunatic that I was involved with, and I'd done this pyramid thing with the money thing. I'd all this money in my knicker drawer, and I just went, he rang and said, do you want to come to New York? I was like, yeah, okay. My kids were away for a week. One kid I had at the time. So I went to New York, and this guy pretended he'd just come out of rehab, and he hadn't. He picked me up from the airport. He was out of his mind, and I just sort of pretended I didn't. I just was like going along with it. Hung out with him for 3 days. The first 2 days I stayed sober, then went to a hotel. Do you want a beer? Yes. Okay, I'll have a beer. Next thing, a line of coke. Next thing, a load of gear. You know, that was it. And I was in New York. And weirdly, the day after, it all was mental. The day, as you can imagine, the day after, I didn't use again. So I'd got something, and I spent another day with this suffering addict. And I came back home, and I went straight back into meetings. I ended up getting a deep vein thrombosis, which I had twice from long-haul flights, but I know now both times it was definitely related to, you know, all of that. And I stayed in again, and then I did another year. I got a sponsor. My first sponsor used to ring me at 8 every morning. Oh, God, she was about a year clean. It was mental. I mean, geez, newcomers, go for somebody, I'd say 7+, but that's just me. That's my experience. My sponsor's got 24 years, and you know, somebody's worked the steps, etc., etc. But I wanted that because I didn't really want it, and that suited me. So, I mean, ringing in the morning, really, it should have been me ringing her. I just used to say, yeah, hello. You know, didn't bother with the steps. I got another sponsor sort of about 6 months in. She was amazing, and I started to kind of, I respected her. She had a bit of time, and she gave me step one. I sort of did a bit of it. Didn't really, you know, I just thought, this steps thing. I don't know, you know, if I'm going, it changes you, you know, just step forward, you change. And I'm listening, I'm hearing everybody, and I'm just thinking, it won't work for me. That's not going to happen to me. I'm so different and unique that I'm the only addict that's this step forward thing definitely can't change. There's no way. That's what I thought. And I was terrified that I wouldn't change as well. My sponsor said, what is it that's holding you back? I was like, I don't know. And I thought about it, and I think it was. I thought, what if I do it? And I'm so horrible and fucked up that I won't change if I do this thing that they tell me is going to change me. So that was a big fear for me. So anyway, I got to about a year, and as I've said before, my relationship stuff with men, my daddy issues, all that, whatever, I'm an addict, and I've got daddy issues, blah, 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 all of that. So I wasn't having really great with men, not much success there. Didn't really know how to do that. And so, you know, the person I went for, I've just come up to a year clean. I remember thinking, I was thinking, I don't want to do this. I started talking about, I'll just maybe have a glass of wine. And I'd started a band in this, but the stuff I got in the first year, can I just say, for me, the relapse isn't the big stuff, like my mum dies of cancer, and it isn't stuff like that. And things going to shit. It's when I get stuff. When you get the promises, you knew you'll hear that, and you'll read that, reading the promises, you know. I was going to quote stuff, but I can't. Sound really good, but I can't. That's what happened to me. So much came to me so quickly. I got another record deal, started a band, it was brilliant, and I ended up going on tour with this other band, and there was a guy, And I just went for the fucking most craziest person that I could possibly have gone for, because I just was like, I don't want this. I want to do something mad, you know. I don't like all this sort of doing good stuff and doing changing. That's how I felt about it at the time. So I went for some. I got involved with somebody, and within sort of a few months, I went on this tour with this, and within a few months, I was using again. And this time, I wanted, because like I said, I had this obsession with heroin. I wanted to be a big heroin addict, but I didn't. I was a bit scared. And I kind of got involved, and I remember this person saying to me, when I took my first sip of drink I had on this relapse, I fell over and sprained my ankle within minutes, dancing to Elastica, I can't remember the name, Connection. Yeah, that was the moment. And I started showing off, and I had two sips, I wasn't even drunk. And I had to do the rest of the gigs on a stool with a thing on my ankle. So that was what happened, and I remember him saying to me, I'll have you up an alley with the sun coming up doing gear, you know. And I thought, oh, and I swooned, you know. oh, amazing. So that's where it was, you know. That's just what I'm just being honest here. So that's kind of, I went down that road, and that, you know, so on that relapse, they say if you relapse, your disease progresses. I've heard that a lot, and my disease progressed. So by this point, I've got my daughter, I'm using heroin, and I swore I'd never touch crack, even though when I had free base, I didn't know it was crack though, so it didn't really count. And I thought, I'll never do crack, because stepdad's, you know, uses crack, and it's devastated my mum, and it's, you know, we've lost him and all the rest of it. And I did, I started using that as well, and it was, like I say, I was sort of very, very controlling, and I had this double life. I'd be with the party lot doing coke and drinking and talking rubbish, and, you know, till sort of 7 in the morning. They'd go to bed, and I'd be lot on the phone to him going to Whitechapel, you know, off I'd go, you know. And at that point, I'd recover in my head, and I just used to do, I mean, I'd do heroin, and then what it was meant to do, it didn't do. I'd just sit there crying. It didn't work. Do you know what I mean? No matter how much I put into my body, it did not work. It didn't do what it was supposed to be doing. So I'd screwed it up my using for myself with recovery. That was it. It was too late. The conscience was there. You shouldn't be doing this. You know, that was in my head. It was awful. I don't suggest it. And so, yeah, it progressed. And in that time, then I got pregnant again. And I'd had other pregnancies before that I didn't go through with. I'll be honest about that. And this one, I felt guilty about that. And I thought, I really do want another baby, I want a son. So I went through with it. I told him, he was like, yeah, great, you'll be a great mum. What I didn't listen to was that I'm not really going to bother being a dad, because I'm enjoying using. So yeah, you'll be a great mum, but, you know. So I went through with this other pregnancy. I had a beautiful boy. And I'm so glad I've got my kids. It's a tough one, because I feel this disease has taken that away from my family, that I've had these children. They don't have fathers. My daughter's never going to have a dad that tells her he loves her. Oh, I'm getting emotional now. I didn't think I'd do that. You know, and that's a huge thing, because I've had to have that as well. And pull yourself together. Yeah, so I kind of, that's for me, that disease has taken that stuff away from me. But at the same time, like I say, it's the best thing I ever did. I've got no regrets there. But I feel very sad for my kids and my daughter that they... But, you know, that's my disease, and I've kind of forgiven myself for that, and I know that that was my insanity, and when I was ill, as far as I'm concerned, I was very ill, seriously ill, mentally ill as well. But I've got these two beautiful children, but I had my son again. I remember using, just as I found out I was pregnant, because I thought his dad was going to get off with one of my friends, that was the reason. I remember going off to you know, thinking I'm going to fucking use, and I did just once. But then I got through the rest of the pregnancy again, and it was another thing. I did it before. This is the insanity of my addiction. And this is the big book, The Jaywalker. Keep going out on the road, get run over, you know, or get in the boxing match with Mike Tyson and think that, you know, keep getting in there, keep getting smashed to pieces every time. Not just with using, with everything in my life, you know, all my experiences. And the second time, I have this baby, this one will save me this time, this one will, you know. And, you know, I've heard that saying, no human power. And I don't believe any human power or anything externally of me can keep me clean, ultimately. Maybe for 6 months, maybe a boyfriend, a nice house, I've said that somewhere before, a car or whatever. You know, I'm a big one on that. I go shopping. If I'm having some feelings, I'll go shopping and buy myself a nice pair of shoes, put them on, I'll be all right. I won't be all right, really. You know, I've still got to come here and like as Aaron said, the steps. And coming round to that, so after my son was born, I didn't come back into recovery. I got a psychiatrist when I was pregnant, psychiatric team, to avoid anything to go to a meeting and admit I was an addict. I thought, maybe I'm mental. Can you come round and tell me that I'm mental? And then, you know, and he came round and he said, yeah, you know, maybe you've dealt with your addiction issues. You know, psychiatrists don't deal with addict, you know. He said, maybe, you know, you sound like you've got it together. Sound like you're just beating yourself up a bit. And what you need to do is just, you know, carry on to the positive and, you know, this baby, you're having this. So I was like, okay, cool. I don't need to go to meetings. Psychiatrist said I don't. So I didn't. And then my son came. And then within weeks, again, I sort of drank a few glasses of wine. And then the next thing I know, I was in a hotel crying, been doing loads of fucking crack with this father of my child, who threw me out. There were two tickets on my car outside with a clamp. Calling my mum, you know, help me. And this beautiful baby and this beautiful daughter, you know. They just said, no, that had no power over me. That couldn't help me. That couldn't stop me using. And that went on for another sort of year and a half, and it progressed and it got closer and closer. The whole kind of, you know, I'd ended up some maybe going, it was all around this man going and using and kind of, you know, and then I'd sort of, we'd have a big fight and then I'd be like, I'm not doing that anymore. And then sort of 2 weeks later, and then it got closer, then I was doing sort of heroin and crack, and maybe it was like, it would be at the weekend, like you say, and then it would be Monday and Tuesday, and then it would be, you know, not Thursday and Friday and Saturday, and then it would just all started to get like that. And I basically kind of hit a rock bottom, as you do, and I started to feel like I've either got to get clean for the kids or kill myself. That's the two options. And I didn't know if I could get clean again. I thought, can I go back in there again after all that? But I did. And this time round, you know, I got clean. Again, I resisted the programme. 3 years in, the second time round, not worked a step. And by that point, I'd moved to the country. I thought the solution is to move near the father of my kid, who's still not sober and using. It's a good idea. Live around the corner from him in a village, you know. And I stayed sober, I don't know how, but I for 3 years, and again, and I got to a point, I had a rock bottom in sobriety, in recovery. I went to get up, you know, I sort of blame London, I'll move from London, that'll do it. Another thing, geographicals, if I go to there, but guess what, I'm always there with me, you know, ow. I'm always there with my, you know, I can't escape myself, you know, no matter where I go. I kind of ended up weirdly by default getting into the meetings, different fellowship, but it was the only one that was available. So I went a lot, I got a really good sponsor. I ended up getting into it because, again, in sobriety, I had a boyfriend, I'm punching him. I mean, the defects that came up with my in relationship will bring your defects up. Yes, it will. And, you know, my behaviour, you know, and I just thought, my God, this is insane. And again, I got to a point where I thought, thank you. Took me 5 minutes, yeah. Maybe I should just kill myself. I mean, what, you know, and I thought, hang on a minute, what am I talking about? I want to kill myself. I'm 3 years sober. I've got two kids. Everything's okay, pretty much, in my life. Why do I feel like this? And I hit rock bottom. I thought, I've got to get, so I thought, fuck it. I'm going to go to these meetings. I'm going to get a sponsor. I'm going to do this. So I did, and I was ready. I did my step four. It was amazing for me. I couldn't wait to do it because at this point I was desperate. The gift of desperation. I love all those things and it's true. I had the gift of desperation. So I did it and step five, I felt amazing. I hear people say, and you know, the most important thing for me, I know if you're new, this is all like Japanese, but the most important thing for me was the steps one, two, three. And three, I had to believe that you know, something could restore me to sanity. And without that, I couldn't really have done step four, I don't think. So I really had to come to believe, and I did. And I was willing, and I did it. Step five felt amazing. I really did. And then I kind of became willing to make amends to people. What? No matter what, that's mental. You know, I'm going to say sorry to people, even if they're not, even though they've done me harm, and not expect anything back. You know, that's not me. But it was. So this step four, it did change me. But, you know, it's a daily thing. I mean, I was in Burger King screaming at a man the other day with my 9-year-old son, swearing and screaming and pointing in his face. I wanted to punch him. That is what I can get, like, you know, doing the steps. And so if I'm not, you know, doing everything, you know, that's just, it's always there for me. So, you know, it's a daily thing for me. I have to come to meetings. I have to kind of go over the steps again. I have to not take other people's inventories, just my own. But it's given me so much, this programme. I mean, all those tools, it's amazing. I still don't know if I can ever... I think, can you ever have a relationship if you're a mental addict? I don't know. It's a bit... But I have hope these days with most things. And I've got a good relationship with my kids. not the best mother in the world, but I've been there for them. I'm lucky my kids didn't get taken away from me, because they could have done so much that could have happened. And that's it for me. I'm a very, very grateful customer, and I can't believe I've actually shared for this long. So, okay. I hope that wasn't too boring. Thanks.
Clean time with key rings, cups and hugs.
Okay. Anybody celebrating multiple years of recovery today this week?